and he could present his case and point out and explain why they're screwing him over or why it's not right. We're so far from that, though.
Absolutely.
That's what I'm saying. That's what's happened to the system. That's why it's not working. I have lawyers call me up fairly frequently to ask me what this means in the act or that means, because they don't know.
I think we're going to get. I'm going to offer that amendment later on. Maybe we can get into this discussion. Then it all started out of just trying to figure out what defense lawyers are getting paid.
Just asking a report. I think that's a good idea.
And this seems to have become the dominant discussion of the day. I'm still amazed how rapidly the phone lines around the state are burning up on this issue. Right.
The reason is because it's seen by most people as not very productive and creating one other layer of work that they've got to do for a reason that they don't see this being having much point.
Yeah, it's been a dominant center of discussion at this table for 4 years. So. Do you have any other comments, Tom?
No, I'm going to. No, you.
Don't quit.
I admire you for having going through this process. I did want to say one thing. This set of amendments is one of the best ones that anybody's attempted so far. The main reason is because the people who did the ad hoc committee spent a lot of time on it, and there were trade-offs. You'll see trade-offs throughout the thing. I see them constantly. So, when you have trade-offs, it means nobody's going to be completely happy with how the trade-offs came down. But they did do something that was the smartest thing. They understood the interaction part, like I talked about earlier, how one section affects another, better than any other set of amendments. They also understood that if you want to reduce litigation, the best way of doing that isn't to mess around with the procedure, how you litigate, and which in turn turns out to be another subject of litigation. You remove the causes of litigation. You try and create incentives that make the injured worker and the employer have the same goal again, like the thing started off trying to do. They tried to do that. The issues that can be where you can save the money by being arbitrary, they've done those trade-offs and tried to make those balanced arbitrary decisions. If they succeed with what they're trying to do, what they would do is put, because if you'll notice, like on the arm example I had, like on my client, the guy who's lost his arm, what they would succeed in doing was putting more money in the pockets of injured workers to cost employers less, because you'd be turning out some of this stuff that doesn't need to be happening now anyway. I'll give you two other alternatives what you can do, because something's going to have to happen, because employers, you've heard some employers testifying, they're telling you they are going to have to close their door if they have to pay these costs. The costs are not going to stop unless something is done. If the costs don't, and the reason is because if you don't let the insurance companies charge more money, they simply won't write them, because they're not going to write money and lose money. They write policies when they lose money. So the increased cost, the way it's going up, will continue. Next year, if you don't get something done now, somebody else is going to be in front of you. I don't think you're going to get another group that's willing to put the kind of time and effort that this group, that the ad hoc committee did. They worked at it intelligently. They started at the bones, you know, what makes it work, how does it work, what are the incentives, you know, how can we make it work for all the people that have an interest, which is everybody that works. Next year, I don't think they come back, after all that work, it turned out to be for naught. Something will be in front of you next year. This one will go through, and I don't think it will be as intelligently thought out. And this question is going to continue to mount. There's two much simpler alternatives I'd like to bring to your attention. One that nobody has brought up, but I think would be cheaper, save the state a ton of money, and probably cost employers less. Simple act, real short one, just says repeal the Workers' Compensation Act. The Workers' Compensation Act, many people feel, and I think you can get economists who can give you numbers for it, has lost its utility. It no longer provides an inexpensive, speedy, informal method of allowing a humane remedy for injured workers. You can give injured workers an established set of law, an established set of procedures that are well polished up with the common law. Let people go back to talk. I think it would be cheaper. That's what workers' compensation is supposed to replace for another reason. I think now the system has gotten so far that it's a cheaper result. The other solution is to go to an entirely different procedural way of handling workers' compensation. Go to something like, use the longshore model, where they have professional hearing officers. It's going to cost the state more money, because they're going to have to maybe hire more hearing officers. to go to a two-tier hearing officer system before it goes into the judicial system. But that'll move things along, it'll also make things happen faster. But you're going to have to do something. I mean, I think you've heard enough to realize that.
You don't disagree if we put a strict penalty in for failure to report attorney's fees?
I don't know what...
Staff just went through a stack of reports. Let me see, here's compensation reports and claimants, and there's a little line down here, 22C, it says employer attorney fees. There's only one in this whole stack here, that, and two or three that I've ever reported. And it's a law now that you have to report them, and nobody reports them. So
again,
if we just took the existing law and put a stiff penalty behind it for failure to report, wouldn't that... Would you agree that solves part of the problem?
Look, I don't know what the problem is. Like you said, it's not a big deal. I don't know how important that information is.
That shouldn't be a problem. Well, I think it is important that we're trying to gather information on cost of all aspects of the workers' compensation so we get a good database. That was opening testimony this morning from Alan Teshi that you can't proceed with this amendment because we don't have a good database to work from.
I don't collect
the data.
I didn't agree entirely with what Alan said. You've got lots of information. The problem is the breakdowns.
We had testimony from the Alaska Timber Trust in Ketchikan that they began breaking all this down in January, and it didn't take them very much to adjust their computers to
it. No, I don't think it would. That's what I'm saying. I don't think it's a big deal. I don't think it would be difficult at all for the insurance companies to provide it. Penalties are always sources of litigation. That's why I don't like
How else are you going to get people to do it?
It's already state law and they're not doing it.
Yeah, make them do it. I don't care. I'm not going to pay the penalty. It's just going to be passed on to policy payers anyway. But ask them to pay it. Urge them to do it, pay it. If you want to put a modest penalty in there, just make them pay it.
That gets to be included in their rate, please?
It's a cost of doing business. You make it a cost of doing business when you make them.
Well, we don't allow penalties in some other rate bases that we have in the state. There are items that maybe cost doing business, but they're not allowed in the rate base.
Anyway, I don't...
Maybe after this, they'll just voluntarily comply.
Maybe they will. I don't have to fill that information in. It's not something I ever have to deal with. I can tell you one thing you should do, though. Perhaps they're worried about. They shouldn't have to report it until the thing's all over. Because it gives information. It's an adversarial system. That's what I was saying before, unfortunately.
Well, maybe it'll help lessen the adversarial part of it if everybody knows what the other person's paying.
I do both, so I can tell you. I can give you the comparative cost. A litigated workers' compensation case usually costs much more to defend than it does a claimant on. A minorly litigated workers' compensation claim costs much less to defend than to present. The reason is because the claimant puts his time in the front end, making his impressive case, and then he resolves it. Okay. What that means, though, is that in terms of who makes the most money when, a claimant makes the most money if he settles his case early. The reason is because he hasn't put the time in, and he's going to get usually the statutory minimum on whatever the case settles for. So if he's got 10 hours in and he settles for $100,000, you figure out how much you make for an hour. If he has to put 150 hours in to get the equivalent of $100,000 of the benefits, then he's made much less per hour. On the other hand, an insurance company that settles quick and gives the money to the claimant's attorney rather than their own attorneys has saved a lot of money, but their costs are pretty low. The other guy's made up like a bandit. On the other hand, if they really believe their case is valid and they fight it out, then they have to cover. It's much more difficult to defend than it is to prosecute a workers' compensation claim. I've handled lots of both, and I can tell you, I can count on one hand the number of claims cases I've lost.
The incentive from that example is that the plaintiff's lawyer has the incentive to settle the claim quickly and early, and the defense counsel, since he gets paid by the hour, has the incentive to drag it out as long as he can.
If what I told you were the only thing that existed, that would be correct, but it's much more complicated than that, of course. It always is.
Any other questions here? Thank you very much. If not, Carl, I know you've been with us from out of town for two days now, and I know you had some prepared comments and you probably have some observations on the system to share with us here.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Carl Anderson. I'm the Executive Vice President of Alaska National Insurance Company. We are an Alaskan company operating in Alaska, employing more than 70 people, all of them in Alaska. We're the largest writer of commercial insurance in Alaska, and the second largest writer of workers' compensation insurance. It has not been our practice to take a position on workers' compensation benefits issues. Benefits are a compromise between the employers who pay the bill and employees who receive the benefits as determined by the legislature. However, we are in a position to observe an erosion in the workers' compensation system combined with the economic downturn that has become a burden to our customers. It is making it difficult for many of them to compete and for some of them to survive. A reform of the system that will reduce costs to the employer is overdue. We support Senate Bill 322. It has been praised by actuaries for hard dollar savings and reviewed by the Alaska Classification and Rating Committee for soft dollar savings. If this bill were passed, the National Council on Compensation Insurance would file a 5.7% decrease in workers' compensation rates. This committee is considering further changes introduced yesterday that indicate additional hard dollar savings. If this bill is passed with additional savings and no added conditions increasing the cost, the National Council would be required to file a rate decrease reflecting these savings. Present law states that insurance rates cannot be excessive. If the new benefit level indicated that present rates are excessive, a rate filing is required by law. We do not support a mandated rate decrease. We are no more pleased with this provision than you would be.
This is Ace at the Bridge. Is General still on the line?
Yeah, we're still here. Not sure, was your mic on?
No.
No, okay. Well, the testimony is by Mr. Carl Anderson of the Alaska National Insurance Company, and the lockdown switch had flipped off. So we'll just pick it up where he's been in his comments here.
We do not support a mandated rate decrease. We are no more pleased with this provision than you would be if the legislature determined what you should charge for your product or service. We do not, a mandated rate change would be counterproductive. Some companies may welcome this approach. It would give them the incentive they have been seeking to leave the Alaska insurance market. Some companies may stop writing workers' compensation because they are philosophically opposed to mandated price setting or economically opposed to selling the product at an inadequate rate. Some companies will continue to underwrite workers' compensation, but very carefully. Alaska National would probably be in the last group because we have no readily available alternative. Alaska is our home. What are the end results? Number one, there'd be less competition. Number two, more business would be going into the assigned risk pool. Number three, we would start account underwriting. With less competition, the price of other lines of insurance will edge upward. There'd be fewer, if any, scheduled credits allowed in workers' compensation. And then there will be a greater use of scheduled debits. We do not support section 21.89.015, refund the workers' compensation premium. The reasons stated also apply to this section. It is a mandated rate reduction. The present filings of the National Council and most insurance companies recognize superior safety performance by experience and schedule rating plans. The administration and policing of the provisions of section 21.89.015 would be extremely difficult at best and impossible to apply fairly and equitably. And that is a statement of Alaska National Insurance Company. I will take any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Carl. Do you have any questions? Representative Cotton?
Thank you. Yes, sir. Do you, as you read the bill and see that there's tools here, I think somebody described them as, do you see a likelihood that rates would be reduced?
Yes.
Without a mandate?
With the Senate Bill 322 has been priced with a 5.7% rate decrease. That would be have to be filed and is required to be filed. If there are additional savings, the law requires that we file for these additional savings. We cannot charge excessive rates. If the benefit costs go down, we are required to file a comparable rate decrease. Conversely, if the benefits go up, we're also required by law to file the comparable rate increase.
Okay, so if the legislature said, well, you have to have a 10% rate reduction, you suggest your company probably stay in business, but that other things might happen, less competition, you might see rates go up in other areas, you might see more people assigned to the pool.
That's correct.
How do you get this, how would that happen? Maybe you could just give me the real basics on how would people be reassigned or otherwise end up in a pool?
Well, people end up in the workers' compensation pool for a number of reasons. I will not say number one, but a very reason of different importance. They may be in a category where the underwriter feels that the rate is inadequate. And this does happen. It happens probably more in individual business where the system just is not, it's not working. It may be a category of work is extremely hazardous and there are not enough companies to want to write this business. It may be, and this happens a lot with our company, we are a small company with a surplus that we must protect in order to write insurance, and therefore we must buy a lot of reinsurance. The reinsurance has certain provisions that excludes certain lines of business. A lot of small employers go in because there are not very many writers of insurance, workers' compensation in the state. There are probably 30 companies that do write in the state. I don't know what percentage, I've not seen it in the last couple of years, but the insurance department could give you a good idea as to what the top companies write. I suspect that the top two companies write somewhere in the neighborhood of 50%.
Let me just ask you, like, I probably should know this, but can you just make an arbitrary decision to move a client into this pool?
I wouldn't say it's an arbitrary decision.
Do you have to answer to anybody for doing it?
I do not have to answer. If I make an underwriting decision, a business decision, normally this would be done on the basis of a renewal or something. If I do not feel it's adequate, if the account has had excessive losses, if the account, it will not follow a safety program.
Can anyone challenge you on that decision? And if so,
the insured could go, could complain to the insurance department. And
and then what would happen? Could the Division of Insurance tell you to make it to change your decision? Or?
No, the Division of Insurance does not make my underwriting decision. We still are in the business, but we make our own decisions. My company has had, I am aware of, since we've been in business 8 years, three complaints. I have three official complaints through the insurance department. There may have been others, those are the only three I have been involved in.
But I'm just trying to get at what the reaction would be from your company if the legislature did say, this bill says 6%, the one consultant said you could probably get to 10% without any real danger, but we could, the legislature could go crazy and put in 25%. So at that point, you still may choose to stay in Alaska, but what you're suggesting is that you're going to put a larger number of your clients into this pool that results in a 20%, in some cases, surcharge over the book rate.
I will underwrite much, much more carefully. I'm still underwriting to protect the surplus of my company. I'm underwriting so that my company can stay in business as an insurance writer in the state. I'm not charging an inadequate rate.
So I clarify, the way you get in the pool, we mandate by law that everybody, employer and state, has to have workers' compensation insurance, right? So if we mandate that by law, we have to by law provide that everybody can go into business can get the insurance. So you either go to the market and they write it directly. If you're a big company, premium over $50,000 or higher, you can negotiate it. But if you go down the list, you get Bob over here or whatever, he can't find any place to put you, nobody wants to write you, you go to the pool. And the pool, I guess, are you mandated to write in the pool? Does everybody want to get it?
Everybody who writes workers' compensations in the state of Alaska participates in the results of the pool. There are presently six service carriers. These businesses are assigned to the service carriers on a rotating basis.
So you're on a rotator, right, and they just assign you a person and
yes,
you got to write the policy.
But the results of this, the premium and the losses go into a a national or an Alaska pool. And at that time, the results are divided among all 30-plus writers in the state based on the percentage of the writing.
Yeah. Same concept I tried to do with medical insurance a couple of years ago, if you guys will remember that argument.
Yeah, I got a bill in something like that.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of bills anyway, so it's the same theory.
There's one other reason that the business is going to the pool. That is, they're working with the wrong insurance agent who does not have access to certain companies. We heard a testimony of one today. He now has an agent who has access to a lot of markets, but his problem, this is a scaffold erector, turned out basically because he was with an agent who had access to very little in line of markets, and definitely did not have the knowledge to advise this man how to proceed. He had a definite problem. That agent happened to be out of business in the state of Alaska, and I think we're all a little bit better.
Okay, I just had one question. On this letter of April 5th we got from the National Council on Compensation Insurance, which states that there is in effect acknowledged the potential overall cost savings contained in the existing version of Senate Bill 322 amounted to 5.7%. Do you know what existing version they were rating?
We were rating the bill as passed by the Senate.
So it was a bill from the Senate, it wasn't the Labor and Commerce version?
That's correct.
How long does it take to get a re-rating done? I guess what I'm getting at is that, you know, I'm not real excited about putting a bill out of this committee without knowing what the dollars are going to be. I see no, you know, it's like I mentioned earlier, I think it's a lose-lose situation if we cut benefits and see no reduction in rates.
Well, there are two groups rating. There's one rating for either this committee or the insurance department, and that's Milliman and Robertson. I know they're standing by, and they'll be able to rate quite rapidly, I'm sure. The National Council is also well aware of this. The insurance department could give them a prod, and I'm sure they could get something out quite quickly. I don't know whether they could do it within a few days, I'm sure.
Okay, thank you. Representative Donnelly, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're on telephone.
Yeah, so do you know what the assigned savings were that were based on paragraph B on page 1? It's a pretty significant change. One of the real philosophical objections I've heard from some members of the public is that this, for the first time, the benefits of the doubt would not go to the injured worker. I was just wondering how much of a savings that resulted in.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't have a copy of right in front of me what they considered. I think this was considered in the soft dollar cost, but as far as what number of the same, I don't know.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Donnelly.
Yeah, and what were the rate increases that were requested last year by the industry?
Last year, 1986 was about 14.7 overall, I believe, and 87. January 1 of 88 was, I believe, 25.3%.
And what was actually the other thing?
That is what was approved.
Okay, there's been some testimony we've had before that though there was a strong feeling in the industry or with the division that was actually too little. Are you saying that they were given everything they were asked for?
They were given everything they asked for. We had about, I think, three versions of computing the rate the rate increase to determine which was which should be filed, and I believe they went somewhere between 25 and 40 some percent. This final decision is usually made by the Alaska Classification Rating Committee. We're not apolitical. We have some idea as to what is possible and can be approved by the insurance department. We didn't think 80% or 40% for them.
Okay. So there's some school of thought out there that thought it should have been 15% more than people wanted 40%, but it should have been 15% more than it was actually awarded.
Depending on how the actuaries approached it, and it probably could have been justified.
Okay. So with the 5.7 rate filing, if that reduction goes into effect, what happens at the end of this year?
The end of this year, we intend to make a rate filing based on results that we have done every year, and the 5%, the 5.7% decrease would be applied to that.
So that rate filing, some members of your industry would want a 15% increase at the end of this year, at least based on what they thought was deficient already from the beginning of last year. And so you might offset that by the 5.7, but that, of course, is based on the results from a year ago, basically.
We have no preliminary idea what that filing would be. Somebody testified 25% or 30% or something. I have no idea where that came from. I believe that Don Koch of the insurance department has indicated that it is his preliminary figures indicate that it is not a very significant increase. I have not seen any preliminary figures. They're usually available sometime around the 1st of July with the final figures out sometime in September.
Well, is there any question in your mind that based on increases that, or the rate filing at the end of this year would be based on the experience before the bill went into effect, and there's a lot in this bill that's supposed to save rates more than just the 5.7, but of course that wouldn't be part of the experience basis at the end of this year, that at the end of this year the industry would be asking for an increase?
I don't know that we would be asking for an increase. I don't have any of this preliminary data.
Any other questions?
Yes, Chairman.
Representative Barnes, on the teleconference, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, over the course of this legislative session, we have heard a great deal of discussion about the cost of insurance rates in Alaska, workers' comp in particular, and how we might address the workers' comp system to bring down the rates so that people could afford to remain in business. If my calculations are correct, in the testimony that you have just given, over the last 2 years, the insurance rate has increased by 40%. And if this bill would result in a 5.7% decrease, that would still leave us with a 34.3% increase in the last 2 years, and looking at a possible new increase in January. I don't see how this bill could possibly help us with those figures that are before us. It seems to me that this committee, with those types of figures, have to look at something to bring down those costs other than what we have before us. And with that in mind, would you tell me how long Don Koch has been with the Division of Insurance?
My guess is about 1970. He was here when I arrived in the state in 1972.
Okay. And you're quite a while then. And I presume in that same job.
Basically the same job, and responsibilities over the years have increased substantially.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have nothing further.
Thank you, Representative Burns.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. The 5.7% represents what the industry is willing to admit to as actual savings contained in the bill. There's an awful lot of other things that are in the bill that, when it was drafted, we think are going to save money, but they're not admitting to it, or else they're at least wanting to wait until that experience comes around before they acknowledge that those will really be savings. But there's a lot of people in the drafting process that thought this would save a lot more than that, and those things haven't been factored in that.
Representative Cotton.
Yeah, thanks. I sure appreciate you showing up there, Mr. Chairman. I hadn't really thought about what was going to happen to the next rate filing, which is, what, next January?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's about when we're about to head back down here, we're going to get the same people screaming at us saying, yeah, I thought you just passed a bill and with a guaranteed reduction. And really what it might amount to is, rather than a reduction of 5.7 or 6%, it'll only be a reduction of 10%.
whereas otherwise it might have been 15?
Go up 10.
I mean, it would only go up 10% as opposed to 15, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
And that's because they won't have had time to gain experience, sir, on what's being changed as far as the statute here?
It was a very short time. The state requires that this be filed, I believe, by the 1st of October or the 1st of November. So they say there's not a lot of time in there to gather much data.
The ironic thing here is we have a letter stating that the enactment of this bill will reduce the result in 5.7% reduction, of which they have absolutely no experience to base that decision on, because the bill isn't even in law yet. And yet we may be looking in 6 months to say that, well, we don't have enough experience to continue a further rate reduction or something on that order. So it's just a little dichotomy that I've been trying to tussle with all week. But, you know, there are some other options here, and we'll look at them, some amendments that could look. You could mandate the rate decrease be in effect for 18 months. You could freeze the rates for the next 18 months until there's rating data to show otherwise. There's a lot of options that we'll have available to discuss.
And that's what Labor and Commerce version proposing.
Labor and Commerce is a 6%.
With an 18-month moratorium.
18-month moratorium on
Representative Cotton? What period of time do you feel that would be necessary to have experience with these rates before you would be able to say that you'd come in with a rate filing that you could
with this, count with on? The standard method of rating the calendar year 1988 results, which would have 50% of that year would be under this law, would be used in the rate filing in calendar year 1990. So there is about a year lapse in there.
Okay, any other questions? Not appreciate your patience to staying with us, and welcome to the legislative process. We have one witness who was on our scheduled in last Wednesday, and we've been putting her off ever since, and I think maybe now is a shot. But Jan Hansen, do you want to?
Chairman, can we ask what the schedule's going to be?
We're running 2 or 3 hours behind, and I've been kind of running through the aspects here. I've asked staff to take every amendment that's been proposed, no matter who proposed it or where it came up, and draft it in amendment form so that we at least have the issue. And there's about 18 of them so far, and there's about a 6-page memo kind of going through some of the reasons that were given for those amendments, whether they, I don't know if it identifies who made them. I'm having that duplicated now, and people can have it and take it with them or whatever. They all have my name on them, and you can yell and scream at me, but most of them are not my ideas. And look them over, and the committee process, it looks to me, looking at what we have in front of us, there's another hour or 2 hours of testimony here to get everybody through, and I know committee members are getting tired, so.
Mr. Chairman?
I think the choices that we're going to face is meeting sometime tomorrow to work on amendments, or going into night meetings next week. And I just leave it up to the committee now. Either choice is fine with me. And maybe why don't we just take 5 minutes here off the record so we can kind of huddle on that and see what we want to do. I know there's a lot of people here in the audience that this week.
Mr. Chairman,
we're going to come back to order.
The committee has trouble.
The committee is back down to its stalwart member. And just to announce to the world what the rest of the committee plans were, I was hoping that we would get to the markup this afternoon. What's happened is all of the proposed amendments, regardless who proposed them, have been, to the best of my ability, duplicated, except for those that have been proposed today, which we will get to work on this evening and circulate. There's a memo from staff to myself with some comments on the impact of the amendments, or trying to explain a little bit about what they mean or whatever. I just want the world to know this is between my staff and myself and has nothing to do with the committee. There are no committee positions, and half the amendments aren't even my amendments. They're somebody else's, just so that when they go out in the world, you guys can take them home with you and look at them, and we'll fax them out to the LIO site so that they can have them too. It's just an attempt to try to speed the process up. We've run into massive problems of trying to meet tomorrow, all the way from observances of religious days and other issues. So the committee's decision basically is we're going to start back on this bill after we finish all the testimony today. We will start with markup only at 8 o'clock Monday morning, and we'll go from 8 till 10. And then we have session. We have session at 10 on Monday?
11.
We may be able to go a little past 10 o'clock on Monday. And then we'll come back in the evening, Monday evening, and somewhere probably around the 6:30 range to work in Monday evening on the bill and see if we can't get a committee substitute drafted, published, and then take a breather for a couple days and let people look over the CS, let the actuaries rate the impact of what this committee has done, let other people kind of feel it and run it through their various committees, and then we'll come back later in the week and see if we have any real major objections, major issues, things we've done that we don't know the impact of, fine-tune it and see where we're at from that point on, and work on it that way. So with that in mind, we'll go to the testimony, and Mano, you can pull that other set around, so there's two of them there. You guys just want to identify yourselves and give us your kind words. This is probably this 18th committee hearing you've had to do this at
so far. My name is Matt O'Brien. I'm the president of the Alaska AFL-CIO.
My name is Dick Cadnaugh, and I'm a member of the Management Labor Ad Hoc Committee. What we'd like to do is take a few minutes of your time. Yesterday, during some of the testimony, Mr. Chairman, you asked for an explanation of how some of the information in the law in our proposal, where it came from, how we arrived at what we did, and I'd like to share with you, if I could, as well as take the time to go over some of the comments that were made yesterday and I guess explain our perception and perhaps differences. And the first thing I'd like to do is call your attention to page 11, which is on vocational rehabilitation. Now, in our proposal, vocational rehabilitation is by choice. The employee decides he wants to get into vocational rehabilitation. He chooses a provider. They jointly develop a plan. So the section I'm talking about is the non-cooperation, which was suggested yesterday that that was ridiculous, that non-cooperation means failure to keep appointments, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The important word that was missed yesterday when that testimony was given was unreasonable failure. The idea is that the employee is picking the plan he wants to get involved with, he is picking the provider he wants to work with, and if he isn't making his commitment, then the thought is that the plan should terminate. And this was agreed upon by both sides. We want somebody to get into voc rehab, we want somebody to get out of voc rehab. We want somebody to get on with their life, and we feel that voc rehab can help with that. So non-cooperation means unreasonable failure, and we think unreasonable is important.
Okay, on that, well, I just want to ask some questions. I'm going to clarify that up. Unreasonable in whose view?
Well, the nice thing is if you read on down, obviously the unreasonable is going to be, in this case, the insurance company is going to say, you are not cooperating. But if you read on down, you can see that in O, the administrator shall decide whether the employee has not cooperated. So there is the right for the employee to say, that's not fair. I was being reasonable, so there is the appeal process that's built into this. So the employee is really not disadvantaged, but we do need the process in there so that if they're not cooperating, the plan can't end.
Okay. Yeah, just let me ask a question here and interrupt them. If I read this the way it is, carrying on here, that believes the employee has not cooperated with the employer may terminate reemployment benefits, I take that that's the code word for voc rehab.
That's correct.
On the date of non-cooperation. So is this the employer making the decision of you're not cooperating, and then that becomes the date of non-cooperation, and then there's an appeal process that the employee has to say, hold it, that's not unreasonable what I was doing. Right, because it has to be an unreasonable action, but my action was not unreasonable, and you should not cut me off. does he get to keep the benefits keep coming while you still figure out whether it was reasonable or unreasonable, or is his benefit cut off and the program, the voc rehab program, terminated until you figure out whether this was a reasonable or unreasonable action? You see what I mean? And I don't know. And it looks to me like you appeal to the administrator of this program.
The way it states right now is that the employer may terminate the benefits on the date of non-cooperation. But we have put in for the board, really, a very, or not for the board, but for the system, a very expeditious appeal process. This is much quicker than almost anything else that happens in the workers' comp system. So that if the employee says, no, I was out of town, I couldn't keep the appointments, it was a death in the family, he does have a relatively quick remedy.
But it's still that the program is cut off. If he's in the middle of some type of program, he's 3 to 4 weeks into it, and he's going on, and somehow something happens, whatever, the money's cut off, he's out of the program until this appeal, which is a 30-day appeal, takes place.
That's correct.
Or he has to fork his own money into this thing to keep going. I assume they don't let him go to school unless they're paying. Is that
our belief? We consider this to be kind of a velvet hammer. There is remedy in there, but if an employee really wants to get through the program, I don't think you're going to find an employer, once they've had some dialogue, is going to put this provision in and go through the whole process.
Mr. Chairman, especially with the changes from the way the law is right now, the fact that we're changing voc rehab to be voluntary based on the employee's wishes and needs rather than mandatory. And we can cite, you've heard a lot of citations, just case after case. We have members of my local union, laborers that have been injured on the job, worked construction all their life. They're some of the finest locksmiths in the state of Alaska now because of voc rehab. But how many times has anybody in this room had to call one? Some of the programs that have been set up because of the mandatory aspect have been ludicrous, and we think that this is going to be a lot better for the employee, which is, gets back to the basic premise.
Okay. Representative Navarro.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I guess my analysis of it would be that it's voluntary on the employee's part now under this bill.
Under the new bill, that's
under
right.
Under the new bill. Under this language, it's voluntary on his part. The determination on whether or not he's reasonably met that is up to the employer. Seems to me, and the benefits are cut off for up to a 30-day period if the hearing is scheduled expeditiously. It seems to me that a better approach would be if upon when either party goes to the administrator, then the administrator can determine whether or not that's unreasonable, and at that point the benefits are terminated. It seems to me like, because that would allow, if the employee felt that he hadn't been unreasonable, for him to demonstrate during that 30-day period compliance or continued rehabilitation, and maybe accomplish what the goal is of the workers' comp, and get that person rehabilitated, rather than have the benefits cut off and the employee get thrown out of the system, and then go to an administrator, and perhaps after that 30-day period, or 2 week, or however long it takes, that employee then has missed that window of opportunity for that rehabilitation program.
We had discussions along these lines. You have to recognize that what we were trying to do with, you're probably right, I mean, you get burned out in this thing. I was on the original ad hoc committee in 1982, and I can't, it's like something you get on your hand, you can't get rid of
it.
Now, I'd like to say that we're going to do
something. We're not talking about Representative Barnes.
But one of the things we're trying to do, we originally wrote a letter to the governor in February 1987 and said, it is the intent of the ad hoc committee to cut costs in the system by one-third. Boy, I tell you, in 16 months, we came up with 5.7%. And that was with a lot of work and a lot of study, and that's the best we could do. But we tried to do it by not cutting benefits. Now, when you get to an area like this, the trade-off you're talking about is non-cooperation. At what point should the benefit stop? When the guy quits holding up his end of the bargain, or when you prove he quit holding up his end of the bargain? And we decided that if he really is not reasonably trying to complete his program, then he has ended his contract. And we determined that that was the time to cut the benefits. But if we cut him wrong, if we were unreasonable and we did not handle our part of the contract correctly, there is a relatively expeditious remedy here. And that person can be reinstated in the program. So it was a cost-cutting mechanism. That's what we were trying to do. We were trying to disenfranchise an employee. But if you add that extra 30 days, he's automatically got 30 more days.
Representative Barr?
Why don't you just turn it around like I've suggested and make it a 15-day hearing process?
Cut the difference.
23 and a half. One other question on this point. On line 3, it says keep appointments. I assume that there's a written plan here that says who he has to keep the appointments with would be written down someplace.
There will be a vocational rehabilitation plan that is developed. And in there, they will set out what this person is going to be doing and what his obligations are. Now, if he's going to be a locksmith, he'll be attending training courses and everything else.
Mr. Chairman, if I might also reply to Representative DeVar's some of his concerns. We have pretty narrowly defined, too, some of the areas. I mean, it can't just be some arbitrary reason. We have tried to define some of those things that are considered unreasonable failure. And those of us from our side, from the labor side, that have been involved in this process, mental stress was talked about today. Well, Dick was commenting earlier, we talked about that for 3 months trying to figure out that language. But those of us that have been involved in this, from our side, each of us handle grievances and arbitrations. And, that's our business, negotiations. 30-day process is real fast as far as we're concerned. I mean, that really isn't much of a holdup. And whether the clock starts running then or a 30-day period, we don't consider that any kind of an emergency or dire need to change that.
Representative Mark?
Well, I guess I'm just looking at the motivation of the employee. And if he was faced with the 30 days from whenever you file with the administrator with getting thrown out of this rehabilitation program, or perhaps getting himself remotivated, or if he felt he had to do something to please you, even though he may have felt he was not being unreasonable in what he was doing, maybe that would motivate him. And the other side of that is if he gets thrown out of the system and 30 days later they say you can be reinstated for however long it takes, perhaps that rehabilitation process will have gone far enough, whatever program he's in, where either he loses what he's gained up to that point or he loses motivation then for any type of rehabilitation.
I think this is an issue here. My comment is, I've never been involved with rope rehab in my life, right? And I'm talking about how to make this thing work with two people who have been involved with it quite extensively. So I guess we'll go through this and it's an effort for myself to become a little knowledgeable about how it works. But I am concerned about, it is shifting the burden of proof onto the worker, laying it onto him, and he has to kind of uphold his part of the deal if he signs it.
What we've done in this, though, is in voc rehab, now we've turned it around. The individual worker chooses the program. He decides he wants to be rehabilitated. He chooses the type of the system he wants to go into. He chooses his rehabilitation specialist provider. Talk to the insurance companies about losing control of the claim. These guys went absolutely ballistic when we started talking about this. They said, how can we control a claim? The worker is the guy that is really controlling what he wants to do. He's in control of his destiny. That was intentional. Well, we said if he's no longer cooperating, it's his plan. He's decided what he wants to do, and now he's not cooperating. Why should I, as an employer, then continue to pay? Mm-hmm. He is making a choice. He wants this.
And some of the reasons for the changes, we've heard many horror stories of the voc rehab specialist in a mandatory program has kicked somebody out of the program because, they talked back to me today and had a bad attitude. And I mean, that specific of an item to muck somebody out before. And we think this process is certainly much fairer.
Representative Barnes?
Well,
on the teleconference.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I didn't know a lot about workers' comp when we started this. I know more now than I ever wanted to know before. And one of the things I have heard, though, is about the people that are in voc rehab and the different companies that provide voc rehab. I've heard some horror stories about some of those companies.
You bet. I concur with that, Representative Carson, which is why that was one of the areas that we definitely wanted to change, was the scope, where instead of being mandatory, it's now going to be voluntary up to the employee.
But the other comment that I have is, and this is a chuckle, I had smiled, and I thought you should know why I was smiling. You had 30 days to negotiate one section of that bill, and 120 days for some people is too long for us to negotiate hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of things.
Sure. I appreciate that.
Okay. You had another section you wanted to comment on?
I had a number of them.
I assume so.
Page 15, section 14. And here we recommend that the committee make, you know, whatever editorial liberties they think are necessary. I'd like to explain what we were thinking about. It's come to my attention that some people were asking, what are continuing and multiple treatments of a similar nature? That language is recommended to us by people in the medical community. I'm not a physician, but let me tell you some of the things that we were trying to get at here, and maybe the language should be cleaned up, tightened, or whatever, and we defer to you on this. We were thinking of things like physical therapy, we were thinking of things like ultrasound, we were thinking of things like acroscope, we were thinking about things like chiropractic treatment, things that are relatively similar that you do over and over and over again. There are probably many, many other things which fit into this. That's what we were talking about. People said that it would be litigated. Well, it may, or I don't know. I'm not an attorney, thankfully. So I don't know if this would be litigated or not, but that's the kind of a thing that we were trying to get at here. If it isn't clear, we'd appreciate anything that you could add to make it clearer. As we go down, though, in the bottom part of that paragraph, what I'd like to do on this one, because this is an area that I've heard people say this is very arbitrary. Where did these people come up with these numbers, and why wasn't it X or Y instead of what they came up with? Recognize that we were a bunch of laymen, We did have people who sit on the board. We had somebody from the Division of Workers' Comp who sat with us and helped us. And we all became educated as we went through this process. The continuing multiple treatments was an area that caused a lot of trouble, because when we looked at medical costs, the medical costs went from about 25% of the premium dollar in 1983 to 37.5% of the premium dollar in 1986. We became very concerned about that. We tried to impose controls in two manners. One is the cost of the actual service. The second is the frequency of visits. Now, the cost of the service, somebody said today that if we put in the usual and customary fee schedule, that's only going to drive up the costs, and the medical community would like that. What that person is failing to recognize is that we have found out as we've gotten into this investigation that many physicians have three fee schedules. They have the fee schedule that you will pay if you walk in as an individual and say, I'm here, and you get a checkup or whatever it is, and you write a personal check. They have a fee schedule that you will pay or be charged if you come in and say, I have Blue Cross Blue Shield. And they have a fee schedule, and always the highest, if you say, I'm a workers' comp claimant. Now, usual and customary, while in many cases, if it's set at the standard, that the suggestion was the 90% level, that would be 97%, the 97th percentile for all treatment. On workers' comp, we think there'd be a substantial saving. We do know that people are charging more for workers' comp. They say it's because of the additional paperwork.
Some.
If we don't mean to blanket all physicians on that. But what we're getting at,
I don't mean to blanket all lawyers either when I offer my comment.
I probably done as well as you in doing that, though. The bottom part, we're talking about frequency of treatment. What we did on this section is we went to a person that the board has felt comfortable with over a period of time. Let me give you the gentleman's credentials. He's a doctor of chiropractic. He has a PhD in neurophysiology, and he has a medical doctor. In looking at some of the cases that he's heard, and this is where the frequency of treatment came from principally, he believes that 5 to 20 chiropractic treatments over a 2 to 4 week period is the average number of treatments required to gain results in most patients. If substantial improvement is shown within this 2 to 4 week period, then it is reasonable to continue treatments for another 2 to 4 weeks. Usually after this period, further treatment will not be successful in alleviating the patient's problems. In one case, in this particular case, he says he does not believe the chiropractic literature supports providing approximately 300 manipulations over a 3 year period of time. Now, this is some of the problems we've had where we have that many manipulations over a period of time, and our feeling was that was excessive. We don't really know, but I mean, just in general, we allow for more manipulations if it's really called for. In another case, he said that approaches would have treated the patient for a period of 3 to 6 months, initially 3 times a week for the first month or 2 months, tapering to 2 times a week and then to once a week by 4 months. This individual, by the way, has published textbooks. As a matter of fact, one of his textbooks is used in most chiropractic colleges. So he's a well-known expert and was a source of a lot of our input and study into this section.
Okay, just so I can maybe get you to comment on some of the issues that have come up on this. One is the, I guess the test is continuing multiple treatment. And, you know, the example we had is, you know, the person in the hospital, right, is that every visit by the, what is a visit, I guess, was one of the big questions. Every time the cardiologist walk in the room, is that a visit? Is he going to have to stop at the door so he doesn't run over the limit and send notes in with the nurse? And, you know, that kind of issue. And the other comment was that the malpractice issue, I guess that's the one that came up this morning from Art Robeson, was that in order to avoid a malpractice claim, that all the doctors will use the escape clause, which is lines 25 and 26, says the physician shall document the excess, or it gets into the written plan, I guess, the written treatment plan for the course of treatment. They'll just write it in the plan that they're going to do the max, just so that they don't get accused of ordering up something less than the max, and then something goes wrong and they're in trouble. So could you comment on what is a visit, and then how do we get around this other issue?
I think the issue of visit is kind of a smokescreen, because what it says is not valid unless the treatments are carried out under a written treatment plan. So if you're in a hospital, the doctor is going to come out, he's going to write out a plan, and if that calls for him seeing you 5 times a day, there's absolutely no question. He has a plan, and that plan is going to be filed. And all we're saying in this is that you have to file a plan. And we're giving a standard.
It says it has to be prescribed before the commencement of the course of treatment.
But it doesn't have to be written. In other words, you don't have to have approval for it. In other words, you start, you see the patient, you understand in your mind, and then you write it down. You come up with a treatment plan.
Okay. I think we're going to probably... we'll go through this section again and again,
yeah.
So I appreciate your comment.
As I say, you may want to rework it, but that was our thought, is that
yeah.
A patient comes in and we want to see a plan. That's all. Mm-hmm. We want to know what the treating physician has in store for that patient. What is it he's expecting? If I treat you for 20 days, what should I see at the end of the 20 days? There should be some expectation, and he should be able to write that down. And that should go to the insurance company. And after 20 days, if that person is exactly where they were on day one, then the insurance company kind of furrow their brow and say, maybe we should get an IME in. That's the kind of thing we were getting at there. But frequently also, by the time the insurance companies got their first indication they had a claim, it's not infrequent for 20 visits or 30 visits to have already been given.
Representative Barnes, you had a question in the bar?
Mm-hmm. I think, Mr. Chairman, the more we talk about this section, the more concerns I develop over the way it's written. The reason being, let's say a patient goes into the hospital, they've had Now let's just use a cardiac patient. And I think that a doctor would be hard-pressed to write down a plan that he could substantiate over any period of time because of patient's changing conditions.
But every time there's a change of conditions, he will change the plan. They do that now.
So he's going to write down a plan that's going to last for however many days. But you're saying when the conditions change, that he'll write a different plan.
He should.
Can you imagine how much paperwork you're going to have?
He's already doing it now. He's already got that in his file.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, if I might comment to Representative Barnes, it gets back to what the intent is. The intent was to, and for those that haven't heard my sermon lately, the reason that attorneys weren't included in our committee, and Kevin Doherty was sitting there as a laborer, not as an attorney. Doctors weren't included, chiropractors weren't included, voc rehab specialists weren't included, because it gets back to the basic premise of the bill, that this is a workers' compensation law, workers' compensation. Not lawyers' compensation, not doctors' or chiropractors' compensation. What we tried to address was some of the abuses that we saw that have occurred, or some of the potential abuses. For instance, not having the doctors be paid under a schedule of usual and customary. There's probably not a person covered here under any kind of insurance program that doesn't have that. Yet there are some that are complaining about how unfair it is. Well, that's because it's in their interest to make sure that there is no cap. The same with some of the other complaints you hear about this bill. So it gets back to the intent. The intent isn't to deprive anyone of any kind of need. You know, a heart attack's a good example. If it was caused on the job, and Lord knows there's probably quite a few of those, The intent wasn't to deny that person any kind of needed treatment, but was to make sure that the person or persons treating that person wasn't abusing the system. That's really the intent.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just follow up. Certainly, I don't mean to be taking the position of doctors or lawyers or any other than looking at what could possibly happen to a worker. In
you
my
bet.
Opinion, if this section is left written, I don't know at this time how to change it, but I feel looking at it needs a little work because of emergency type services.
On that, and this is again back to the statements on this section, we certainly, if it needs to be clarified, I would encourage you, because our intent, we thought that it covered hospitalization. If it's not clear, we definitely did not intend to disadvantage anybody who's in a hospital by this. So by all means, clarify.
You bet. And if you can come up with a way to clarify that, you sure won't hear us complain about it.
Representative Barr. I have a good friend who always tells me about the road to hell being paved with good intentions. So.
We're spinning that
wheel. No.
Is he a politician?
No. I guess. Well, maybe before I am not familiar with voc rehab, but I have gone through rehabilitation a number of times for a shoulder and a couple knees, and I'm not sure.
You've been our designated hitman to the hospital this year, Representative Barr.
I'm not sure if there was any real written plan when I went in, other than they're going to do these treatments until the leg got up to a certain strength. And I kept going until I got up to that certain strength. Now, if you had to do that, and I was going every day, and I went every day for 6 weeks, that would be, what, 30 days? You know.
If you, Saturdays and Sundays? Or
just
weekdays. 30.
So that'd be 30 days. Is that covered?
Yes.
There's no written plan. They're just saying this. The plan is up until you reach certain strength or range of motion and strength. That's the plan. And as long as the treatments are commensurate with that plan, then they're covered.
And all we're asking is that your physical therapist, that's who's providing it, write that plan so you know what the expectations are, and the insurance company or the employer knows what those expectations are. And the insurance company may say, that's excessive. But they've got to get an IME then. They may look at it and say, we know the injury, we believe that's appropriate. It could be 100 visits in the first 5 days, if it's appropriate. But all we're saying is there should be a need to know, both for you and the insurance company.
Okay, well, maybe it's taken care of in here, but every patient is different. And if for one patient it may take 60 tables, for a highly motivated patient it may take 20 and a lot of work on his own. And if you're going to have an IME coming in and making that determination based on, maybe it's the only way to do it, based on the whole, you're trying to hit the whole picture with a real narrow IME evaluation. And each individual, I mean, there's a whole spectrum. Some of them, like I said, may only take a few and do a lot of rehab on their own. Others may have to go every day and have to be pushed by the rehab specialist every single day. And so the IME comes in and says, well, standard for this is they should be able to go 3 times a week, and that should cover them. They should work out a couple times on their own. And then you take that one, right, under the bill, you take the IME's work.
We're talking, they're really, the process, and I'd like to get into that a little bit later, but the process is, you have your doctor, you go to your physical therapist, and you get this prescribed treatment, and that plan is sent to the insurance company. And after the period of prescribed treatment, they say you should be able to do these things. But if they say there's no progress and they want to do it again, the insurance company may say, no, we're going to send you to an independent medical evaluation. And that doctor looks at you and say, that prescribed treatment isn't right. Now we have a difference of opinion. That then would go to the board. Now, the person who testified before us, this was one area where we disagreed. He says, we call him a super doc, that's what we've been calling him. The person is independent, truly independent. But one of the things that hasn't come out is our belief in the way this would be handled is that they would be picked by the board members. We've come up with a list of people who are not pro-claimant, they're not pro-insurance company. They are fair doctors that both sides feel comfortable with, that the board feels comfortable with. When that person reviews the files and that individual, he will make a determination. And in your case, he may say, yes, he needs more of this. That's it. Case is over. You go back. He says, no, the treatment was excessive. That person is ready to go back to work, or at least go back to work, or whatever the issue may have been, that's the decision.
And is there an appeal process to that other than the clear and convincing evidence standard?
Through the board.
And that's another section. We haven't quite got that section.
But that's what we're getting at.
This committee's good at trying to clean things up. We'll work on this treatment side.
God bless you.
The next item is page 18. You've heard some testimony on this. Right at the top of the page, this is requiring the IME to be in the same specialty as the treating physician. It was the intent of the ad hoc committee at all times to try in the IME process to provide the best medical care and medical opinions they could to the injured worker. We do not believe that the language as set forth in that first full paragraph, lines 1 through 5, achieves that. As a matter of fact, we believe what happens is quite the opposite. Not only may a person not end up with the best medical treatment, but what we're doing is adding additional litigation to the system. And one of our attempts in this was to try to cut down on litigation. Things that have to go to the board are going to be delayed. The board right now is looking at 60 to 90 days for hearings. So if this has to go to the board merely to select a doctor, we've delayed the whole process by 60 to 90 days. We think that could be done administratively, and we would like to recommend that be done administratively. If you change it from unanimously to majority, it still has to be heard by the board. It's still the delay. We would suggest you go back to both the amendment or the drafting that came out of the Senate, 322. We think it can be handled administratively. In the last 6 years, as I've worked on workers' comp, and in the last 16 months on this particular legislation, I found out that labor does represent the injured worker quite well. And they believe that the board is the place that the worker can be taken care of, that they can come up with fair doctors whose specialties would look after the best interest of the injured worker. So we'd recommend that that section be deleted. The section that right below that starts the opinion of the independent medical examiner shall, in the absence of clear and convincing evidence to the contrary, be presumed correct. We know that the committee has trouble with that. Again, we would look to the committees for some guidance on that. Let us explain some of the concerns we have. The super doc, in our mind, is the guy that should be the person who casts the deciding vote. Part of the problems that we run into is that the Supreme Court has said that the treating physician shall be given greater weight. Doesn't make any difference if he's in the majority or the majority or minority, he shall be given greater weight. We felt that in this case we would like to give greater weight to this impartial referee or judge. And that was our intent. We had a dispute, we had two professionals who didn't agree. We go to this impartial medical evaluator, he makes a determination. We would like to give that person the greater weight. The issue should be decided at that level administratively. Whether clear and convincing evidence is the appropriate standard or not, it was suggested to us it should be. We just want to overcome the hurdles that the Supreme Court has put up for us. That's how we arrived at that. And again, we defer to the committee on some guidance.
The final hook to keep people here has been put on the table over there, but copies are going rapidly.
Page 23, section 29. Yesterday it was suggested that in section 2330-175, section 29 in this bill, rates of compensation, what we were trying to do in that was raise the minimum wage from $110 as it currently exists to $154. A lot of employers, rightly or wrongly, had heartburn over the 200% of average weekly wage, which amounted to, prior to this year, just over $1,100. This is a cost to the, this section costs us all money now. This is an increase in the system cost. Labor wanted this. The 154, even though it seems like an odd number, is arrived at because that is the minimum wage. $3.85 times 40 hours a week is 154. There are a lot more people that are going to go from $110 to 154 than people coming from $1,100 to $700. That amendment is going to increase the cost of the system. But from a humanitarian standpoint, it was felt to be the thing to do. I was suggested yesterday that is probably unconstitutional, and I have a hard time with that, but again, I'm not an attorney. Every state in the union that has workers' comp arbitrarily sets minimums and maximums. And all we're doing is raising the minimum and lowering the maximum. So it is arbitrary. We admit it's arbitrary, but we don't think it's unconstitutional. We think it does help some of the people in the lower end of the income scale. We do not think it disadvantages too many people on the higher end of the income scale.
I don't think there's a constitutional question here. I mean, yeah. I think the issue was this concern about the ad hoc committee being an informal citizen group out deciding major social policy. But I think in the end result, this committee, as part of the legislative process, is going to be the last decider of what this social policy is going to be. So it's, it's a question
sure
whether you have
21,
11, and 1 behind you, then social policy will be determined.
Sure, you've heard the numbers, but in order to qualify for the $1,100 a week, you had to earn upwards of $80,000 annually. And even at the $700 rate, we think it's fair.
And it was easy to cut that down because the only people who make that much money are labor union leaders, and they decided to make pay cuts.
Well, I can tell you, it isn't legislators.
And those involved in management.
The next item, page 24, subsection B1. Again, the issue was raised yesterday that this may be a constitutional issue. What we were doing there was trying to adjust the amount of money that goes to a worker, an injured worker who's living out of the state of Alaska. And we tried to do that through a cost of living adjustment. We've had attorneys testify that that probably is constitutional, but who knows what the Supreme Court looks like.
I don't think there's any objection in the legislature to that. We'll give it a try.
One thing that came up this morning is that you probably can't do it. The United States government doesn't have cost of living standards. There is an organization that does it. The Division of Workers' Comp has already been in touch with them, and I guess they're ready to enter into a contract with me to provide that information. Page 26. The last line on section 32. I have to apologize to the chairman for this. Yesterday you asked me a direct question, and I was wrong. The last line should be deleted. I think I indicated that that should go from 2 to 5 years, and I was wrong. That should be just deleted entirely.
Yeah, I think my question is current law, it's unlimited now.
It's unlimited.
The question,
that's
the other section, you were going to current law, and then my question is this section should be going to current law.
And so
that's correct.
And I apologize for that.
My independent insurance advisor over here to my right caught that one.
Yeah, she was going to point it out to me.
It's an IIA over here.
That's why I'm here today.
Page 28, section 33D. And this one was addressed this morning. The issue came up again yesterday. And again, it was a negotiated item in terms of you had a pre-existing injury and how much the employer should pay. We were adamant that, and I happen to have a sports injury, I guess as some of you might have, that if I were injured on the job, my employer should not have to pay for any disability that was attributable to my sports injury. They should have to pay or any portion of the injury that was attributable to my job injury. But I've got a bad knee, and that's probably, if it were rated, it might be X. And if I injure that knee, they should pay the difference between the degree of disability after the injury and X. And that was the intent. That's our intent here. I should not be rewarded for the fact that I have a sports injury. Pretty stupid of me the way I got it, but it shouldn't be a reward now.
No, we're not going to allow comments on stupid sports injuries.
And you're not going to allow them to be rewarded?
Representative Barr.
Yeah, I guess then we're going to end up in litigation to determine how much of it was attributable to the accident and how much was attributable to a prior injury. I mean, I haven't had sports injuries, but I feel like I'm totally rehabilitated.
It could very well end up in litigation. I would think, though, that what an employer is going to do is balance the cost of litigation for that different employment. And it'll be an economic decision, but it could end up in litigation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how does that...
That's pretty subjective, really.
You go to medical doctors, and they would say, they would come up with some opinions. So you're right, it's subjective.
The question I have is, how does that relate to Section 5, where we're getting into this pre-employment questionnaire regarding physical condition in terms of trying to figure out whether you're going to get workers' comp or not? I mean, are we going to end up with, I guess somebody's going to pre-print pre-employment questionnaires to make this clear, but if you don't disclose your prior sports injury...
No, I think if you read Section 5, as a matter of fact, I've been told legally, and you're an attorney, so I shouldn't tell you what that means, but...
That doesn't stop anybody else from trying to tell me that.
May not receive benefits under this chapter if the employer relied upon the false representation, and this reliance was a substantial factor in hiring, and there was a causal connection between the false representation and the injury to the employer. Now, the employer has a pretty heavy burden to say that I wouldn't have hired me because I've got a bad knee. Well, I'm an accountant. My knee doesn't affect, well, maybe it does, but shouldn't affect my ability to do my job.
Tell me.
Might have to ask how many toes you have.
I can still count those.
Okay, but I'm just, if the person is hiring for some, you know, heavy lifting, and you have a prior injury, I guess, on your knee or your back or something that if the employer knew, they may not have put you in the position where you're at. I mean, so we get through one and two. They relied, there was a causal connection, there was a damage, but I'm just trying to get here. Section 5 goes well beyond prior workers' compensation claims. I mean, we're getting down to here to requiring disclosure of all existing physical impairments that may be related to the job application, I guess.
What we were getting at in this section, and again,
three,
maybe the wording should be changed. What we're getting at is exactly what you inferred from. If I'm hiring somebody and they're going to be a bulldozer operator, and they tell me that they don't have a back problem, and I put them on a bulldozer, and they get injured, and it turns out that they had a back problem. Now, I never would have put them on a bulldozer had I known they had a back problem. But they didn't tell me, and I put them on a bulldozer, and they got injured. What we're saying is that the person has to take some responsibility. And if you tell me what the warts are that you're bringing to the job so that I understand, and with that full knowledge, I put you on a bulldozer, then I should be responsible. But if I understand you've got a bad back, I should find some other work for it.
So the employers and the employees and the employers in the position of having to adequately describe the job.
Right.
The employees in the position having to disclose all prior pre-existing injuries that may have some impact on that job.
Visibility to the job.
But if you disclose it, the employer won't hire them.
That may or may not. We do have discrimination language in here. I've got to be able to show.
I'm glad I have the two of you there because this section, these relationships of this intertwined, this field been bothering me. I just want to understand that. The employer has to describe the job. The employee has to disclose all the injuries. But if he discloses all his pre-existing injuries, the employer may not want to hire him for that job. If he doesn't hire for that job, then the employee sues him for discrimination.
No, thank you.
You see where I'm getting? Going down this road here. I'm trying to figure out where it ends.
I could discriminate against you if you have a bad back and the job I'm just looking at required you to have a good back.
So that's the defense in the discrimination case, is that the adequate job description fits the adequate injury disclosure and they match. Right? One is mutually exclusive, so to speak.
That is right.
And if they're not mutually exclusive, then the discrimination claim would be valid.
In the subsection, it says knowingly also, which is a fairly high standard. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you may have had back problems in the past and gone through a rehabilitation, haven't had a problem in a good number of years, and you feel like you're in perfect health, and you apply, and if you go work on a bulldozer and you get hurt, back gets hurt, then that still wouldn't exempt you from workers' comp coverage, right? I mean,
saying if he doesn't disclose.
If he doesn't, I mean, he may have had a 20% disability in your back.
Well, what if I didn't have any? What if I just had a sore back and I went to treatment for a while and felt like I was in 100% good shape again, and it didn't curtail any other aspects of my life, and I felt like I was in 100% workable condition, and I went in, but the same thing that maybe I was treated for before and it wasn't accurately diagnosed comes up and grabs me.
It sounds to me like you would have had a back strain or sprain. You put that down, you wouldn't be discriminated against. You have no disability.
Well, you know, I mean, when I was a kid one time, I fell out of a tree and landed on my back. And it hurt, you know. And I don't think there's anything wrong with my back right now, but maybe I did some damage that's going to pop up sometime. And I went through treatment and had some x-rays done, and I think I'm fine. You know, but if I went to work and someone put me on a bulldozer and I got hurt, and I said, well, I didn't disclose that. I haven't had a problem for 20 years, but as a matter of fact, I did hurt my back when I was in the third grade, and that would be covered.
Knowingly making a false
statement. Well,
that has nothing to do with the injury. Knowingly make false statements means that you has to do with the false statement.
That's what I'm getting at. I think knowingly is a pretty high standard. I mean, it would have to show that the person was intentionally trying to make a false statement in order to get employed. I mean, that he didn't want the employer to know that he had had a sore back. You're the attorney, Mr. Sunset.
I think the attempt is if you knew you had a bad back, and let's get to the extreme case, you had a prior claim of which you had surgery done on your back, and you did not write that down, you have knowingly made a false statement. Now, if you woke up on the wrong side of the bed, there was a kink in your back, and maybe told your friend about it, right, but you didn't tell the employer, and later the employer found out through the friend that you thought you had a bad back before you got employed. I can see the lawyers getting, salivating over this one already, but I think I see where the line is, but I'm just trying to get all the relationships down here, because the penalty in here is pretty severe. You are barred from your comp plans, and if we take Robeson's recommendation, is that you put this in a form where it states not that you say you waive your rights to comp plans. His argument is that you may bar him from comp, but you can't bar him from tort, unless it's a waiver, an annoying waiver of their right to sue. And that's just another way to get to the same result. The person is not going to get any comp, and they're not going to be able to sue in tort. Basically, pretty heavy penalty.
But again, Mr. Chairman, it stems from what we have seen of some true abuses of the most severe kind of back injury and surgery, and somebody going out on the job, and within the first hour, lo and behold, picking up something and having the back go out, and that employer then liable with the, with the claim.
Yeah,
and there are some severe examples like that.
Yeah. I think the knowingly test is probably the high level of test to relate to the high level of penalty. It's one against the other. Representative Barnes, you had a question?
No, I think I'll skip it.
Mr. Chairman, I'd also like that. I know there's a great deal of concern over what's going to happen. I certainly can't speak for the non-union contractors with our experience, but as far as the union contractors that we dispatch people to, and there are some who have questionnaires and forms, and people who've been injured and fill them out.